I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It's the number one bestseller in British Columbia today and has even sold well across the country, placing in the Globe and Mail's bestseller list. A Matter of Confidence, the inside story of the political battle for BC, is the compelling record of what happened in recent political history with the rise and fall of Christy Clark and the BC Liberals, and after 16 years, the return of an NDP government headed by John Horgan. The authors of the book join me now, two reporters who've been at the fore, Rob Shaw of the Vancouver Sun, who's covered the legislature for 10 years now, and Richard Zussman of Global BC, who has covered the political scene since 2014, initially for the CBC. It's a gripping book that takes the reader behind the scenes, whether it's the caucus rooms of the NDP and Liberal parties at Government House when the Lieutenant Governor had to make a critical decision after the fall of the Clark government weeks after the 2017 election last spring. You get a sense, too, of the personalities involved, what it's like to covering the provincial capital and the issues that concern British Columbians, whether here in Metro Vancouver or in the interior and the north. And, of course, the reader marvels yet again at the complexities and uniqueness of politics out here in British Columbia. The book is published by Heritage House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person this morning, Rob Shaw and Richard Zussman. Mr. Zussman, good morning.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for having us.
And Mr. Shaw, good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it. So the reaction to the book, the sales, so the critical success of it, I mean, that must have been made this whole thing all the more worthwhile.
It's amazing that people want to buy it. You know, again, today, top 10 bestseller in Canada. And this, the incredible thing about this is a book that is basically being sold in one province, and we're competing against books that are from national publishers that are in every bookstore in the country, and we're competing with them 2 weeks in a row now, top 10 on the Globe and Mail list, number one in BC for BC publishers. It's been incredible, and I think we're just excited. You know, the work that Rob and I do on a daily basis as legislative journalists is we hope that people are paying attention and want to know how their government works. And we're thrilled that people are coming out to buy the book because it shows that there is an interest in understanding BC politics and understanding this incredible, you know, run that we've been on here that, you know, really led to this, that the confidence vote was sort of the end of it all, but all the lead up to it was just so exciting.
I guess we didn't see very many books, I guess, from the end of the Socred era to, say, through the NDP years, the Campbell years even. Does this suggest that more books on BC politics will be written?
I hope so.
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I think part of the challenge is you need time to really judge the legacy of premiers. And we're only getting to Gordon Campbell now because he was so unpopular after the HST and he basically sent to exile out of the province. And it's only now with enough time we can look back and say, well, he was really ahead of his time on the carbon tax. He tackled First Nations reconciliation before that became the issue that it is today. It's very difficult to do that with Christy Clark right now because it's just too fresh. And so when we decided to do the book, we wanted to make it a contemporary kind of narrative nonfiction book. It's not a history textbook. It's not footnoted. It's a read of this crazy time in BC politics from the HST to now that we hope, for people who maybe got involved in watching politics over the HST or over one of the elections, aren't political junkies, but just kind of got interested in it, that they can get into this book because it's not written as a textbook. It's written as something that hopefully ordinary people can read as well.
And it's a book that for people like myself who followed this a year ago, who follow politics regularly, I mean, there's stuff in this book that I didn't know about. And I think, I mean, that's to your credit, that so many people talk to you, and especially the main players. And then when they talk to you, I guess everybody else just fell in line, right?
And that's a huge part of this. And we have to thank Christy Clark for that, because she didn't need to do the interview for this book. She sat down for multiple interviews. She had already left politics. She didn't have to ever speak publicly about this era again. And she was willing to do it. But more importantly, when her staffers went to her and said, Richard and Rob have approached me to do an interview, she said, sure, go ahead. And the book would not have been this book if not for them, you know, painting those pictures behind the scenes and explaining decisions and explaining the process by which political decisions are made. And so it was really quite good of her to do that. And, you know, we interviewed 70 different people, more than 75 interviews, over about an 8-week span from the end of July through August and into September. So it was raw, as Rob mentioned. But it was, I think that was the best time to get so many of these anecdotes from people.
Yeah, because it was right after, and it was the summer, I guess, when you did this and everyone was sort of, you know, wasn't
recovering.
Yeah.
And the Daryl Pleckis, you know, Clark had just resigned, and Daryl Pleckis, the news had just come out that he had stood up in that caucus meeting and spoken out against Clark, and Horgan was just getting comfortable in the premier's office. I think we may have been close to the first journalist that got to interview him in his new premier's office for an interview for the book. So I think all of this was new to a lot of people. They were getting used to their new positions, to their new jobs, to their new reality. So it was a good time to get a lot of raw emotion from people.
There's a photo in the book of Pleckis sitting in the legislature that you took, because I noticed that the credit was to you. Did people at the, because that's before the House sits and they were going to pick a speaker.
Yep.
Did any of you know that was going to happen?
Mike Smith seemed to know.
There was speculation, you know, that the Liberals felt like maybe in retrospect Daryl Pleckis wanted to leave when he pushed Christy Clark out at the Penticton meeting.
The caucus meeting a month earlier.
And that he didn't leave at the time because there was all these, we sort of detail in the book how he was going to quit, but when Clark left, they rallied to keep him in the caucus. So they're not surprised when they look back on it that Pleckis ended up doing what he did. But at the time, we were all stunned because, it happened so quickly.
Yeah.
And I remember being in the hallway and seeing Daryl Pleckis sitting alone in the chamber and saying, "Hey, Richard, look at this." And he came down and he pulled his camera out and took a picture, which is in the book. And that was the first moment where we thought, uh-oh. Something big is about to happen here.
Yeah.
Because what was happening is there were caucus meetings.
So you had to be there for
right. So the Liberal caucus was meeting on one end, and he should have been in that meeting. And if he wasn't in that meeting, it means he had left caucus. And if he was hypothetically going to join the NDP, he would have been in the other caucus meeting. So we knew the only option at that point was speaker. The other part, again, that is all in the epilogue of the book, because we try to end it chronologically when Clark leaves. But really, the end of the book is Horgan becoming the premier. And so all of the speaker stuff unfolded afterward. And one of the anecdotes, the stories that didn't make it in the book, was that there were a few NDPers. The process by which they pick the speaker is that you have to go submit a piece of paper saying, "I do not want to be speaker."
Mm.
So there were a few NDPers, Raz Shohan and Spencer Chandra-Herbert and Leonard Krogh, who had not submitted their names, so they were going to stand for speaker.
Yeah.
And a decision was going to be made amongst the MLAs who that speaker was going to be. And when the NDP got word that Pleckis wanted to do it, they called these guys frantically and told them, "You have to come back to the legislature and hand in your slip of paper to show that you do not want to be speaker, because we're not going to run anybody against Pleckis."
And you write in the book that when the caucus finds out, I mean, they were quite happy because this meant that there was stability
in the legislature.
Yeah. Yeah, and so do you think that'll hold for 4 years?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. I mean, it's stable now. The Liberals don't have the votes to topple the Greens and NDP, no matter the speaker situation. But, you know, that we keep watching Andrew Weaver, the Green leader, criticize John Horgan over certain policies, Site C, the LNG tax breaks, the climate plan, and we're all wondering if he's going to do something about it, or he's just going to let it go, and we're going to get the full four-year term here. So this fall will be a really deciding moment. Andrew Weaver has said that he wants to see the climate plan from the NDP, and so that is also the time we have the referendum on proportional representation. There'll be a lot of decision making on the future of the government being made around then.
Yeah, I think I've in interviews said that I believe this is going to get to 2021.
Right.
I don't think, you know, the NDP waited so long to get to power, and there's no thought within that caucus, I think, to derail that, because they've waited a long time to be in this position and they're governing the way they want to govern. The Greens control the power in a minority situation, but again, they're in as good a position as I think they could have ever expected. And then it comes down to the climate plan, I believe. This is why Andrew Weaver got into politics. He was frustrated with the way that Gordon Campbell was dealing with his own climate policies and strategy, and Weaver wanted to come and change that. So we'll see what happens out of that climate strategy, which is expected this fall. If it is a big disaster and something that Weaver doesn't believe he can support, then maybe we'll see a shakeup. But I believe that Weaver will have a huge part in this. The NDP needs him, and they know how important the climate action plan is for him.
I'm going to jump around because there's just so much in this book that I want to get to, and my notes are not in order. And so this speaks to the agreement that the NDP and the Green Party put together. Looking back at it after reading your book and hearing what's been happening in the last few days with what Weaver has been saying, it seems that if this was whatever this you call this thing, a coalition or an arrangement, the NDP got the better deal.
So it's a power sharing agreement, and I think that the better deal idea will be determined really after the climate action plan comes out to see what's in that. And then also the steps that are made on early childhood education. I think what people often forget is how complex the Green Party platform was. It wasn't just a platform based on carbon emissions and increasing the carbon price. It was a platform that was based on big ideas. I remember covering in the election, lots of money spent. Education was the number one thing that Weaver wanted to focus on. He basically wanted to get, I think, people who were age 3 and up into the education system and provide a really holistic, universal child care and early education piece to that. And we're seeing steps the NDP is making towards that. They're never going to fully get there. But there's also issues on wages and a working wage and testing that out in some communities in the province. So Weaver is getting some things that were big signature parts of his platform implemented by the NDP. But clearly, you know, when you have two choices and only two choices, you're not going to get everything you want. And the Greens, I think, may have been a bit naive in that approach, right? The NDP only had to go one step further than the Liberals. They didn't have to go 10 steps further than the Liberals because they were competing against one other party for power. And the Liberals basically wouldn't move on the big energy projects. And the NDP was willing to increase the carbon tax, which the Liberals were not, which we detail in the book. And then they were also willing to send Site C to the BC Utilities Commission, to keep pushing to stop the Trans Mountain Pipeline twinning. So all of those things around emissions and carbon were essential to Weaver, and he just wasn't going to get them with the Liberals. So I think the NDP knew that and therefore did not have to move that far on other things.
So, Rob, I guess it's too early to tell whether this is whether Weaver, I guess, didn't ask for as much as he should have.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Greens, it's a bit of a nightmare scenario for them to imagine almost a year later you have an NDP government that not only continued construction on Site C, but is offering bigger tax breaks on LNG than the Liberals ever did. I don't think if they could have seen that coming, they might have gone about it a bit differently. But, you know, it's the great tension in politics right now. Andrew Weaver, John Horgan, two guys who didn't like each other a lot prior to the election, who've had to make peace, who have this fragile kind of arrangement that they continue to hold on to for both of their benefit. I mean, the Greens, you know, if we had another election and with slightly different results, no one would even be talking about them. They'd be three MLAs. It's because of this unique, unprecedented, you know, ability for them to shift the entire vote with just three MLAs that we're all looking at their platform and talking about what they want. And if we have another election and it doesn't break out that way, Andrew Weaver isn't going to be the kingmaker anymore.
And the other thing I was wondering is there's so many what ifs too in this book. If Sonia Fersenau had not won her seat, she would not have been in the room for these negotiations. And would it have been better for the Liberal Party at that point, and say Christy Clark would have been in the rooms to negotiate?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It's, again, what-ifs to the what-ifs, right? Sonia was still the deputy leader, even if she'd lost hypothetically. They could have invited her to be part of it, but I agree with you, that probably wouldn't have been true. It's worth mentioning that Fersenau had this incredible dislike for the Liberals, right?
Made her sick, right?
Yeah, it did. Physically ill, the idea of supporting the Liberals. And I'll make two points to that. First, the reason why is contaminated soil in Shawnigan Lake, which is where she lived in her community. And she was a strong advocate for her, and that's what pushed her into provincial politics. And the book details that as well. The other point is that a lot of Liberals blame Fersenau. So she never gave them a chance, and she was always going to go with the NDP. Fersenau and Weaver had a discussion about exactly that point. And Weaver was concerned about that too, right? Because he was leaning towards the Liberals, and he wanted to make sure that Fersenau came in with an open mind. What was the best deal for British Columbia and for their supporters? And he believed that Fürstenau could go in there with an open mind and really analyze what was best for supporters. Adam Olsen's their third MLA. He wasn't part of the negotiating team, but he was sitting in a room right next door. And every time they would caucus out, it's called, and leave the room and have a discussion, Olsen was a big part of that. So, yeah, the what if is intriguing, that if she had lost in Cowichan Valley, but this, the whole election would have been different if that riding had gone differently, because that was one of the signature races in the entire province, right? Is this three-way split, but that the Green vote, you know, that area did not want the NDP, that the party was crumbling there. They had issues with their nomination, you know, in and around Duncan, there was a lot of frustration with the NDP. There was no incumbent running there after a long time incumbent had left, Bill Routley. So it all of it lined up really well for the Greens. And that was the sign that if it was a good night for the Greens, they needed to win that seat, and they did. And that's part of what gave them the three to give them power.
The other thing is, I'm reading the book and I'm wondering, you know, say the NDP had gone more negative during the campaign, would the result be different?
In the 2017 campaign?
Yeah.
Well, I remember in 2013, Adrian Dix wanted to run a positive campaign. It did not work well for them. And 2017, I don't think they held back going negative. In fact, you can make the argument they assassinated Christy Clark's character with some of their
right.
ads. You remember the one of her on the throne
yeah.
and the cash?
Yeah. But what in the book, what I recall is that there was a moment there where David Eby wanted to go more negative, and he was sort of, I guess, held back by the leader's office. Is that true?
You know, David Eby was making a lot of gains at the time on the housing file. And he was, in a weird sort of way, almost the leader of the party in terms of the publicity he was getting. And we chronicle this meeting where there was actual tension between him and John Horgan. People were saying to David Eby, you should be leader of the party. You know, you're out there. You're more popular than John Horgan. Everyone knows who you are. And David Eby and John Horgan had to have a meeting after Horgan's office tried to tell Eby to pull things back.
Mm-hmm.
And they hashed it out. John Horgan was willing to walk away at that point, which is an amazing thing to think about. You know, like a year before the election, the guy who's premier now was willing to quit
yeah.
if David Eby wanted to do the job, if he could do it better than him. And they settled their differences, and Eby threw his support behind Horgan, and he's one of his top ministers now.
Another what if had, well, I guess it's hard to say how the Liberal Party conducted their campaign, because they were very disciplined in the three campaigns that Gordon Campbell ran.
Yeah.
And then the one that Christy Clark won. This one seemed to go off the rails.
It did. They didn't seem to have a unified vision in terms of what they were pushing. And part of what made it go off the rails was this interaction with Linda Higgins at a grocery store in North Vancouver.
I am Linda.
Yeah, and so that in itself was a pretty minor interaction. For those that don't remember, Linda Higgins walked into a grocery store in North Vancouver. She was across the street at a medical appointment, or actually she was across the street for lunch with her husband, who was just at a medical appointment. She came across the street, walked in. She didn't like Clark. She wasn't mm-hmm. a Clark supporter. She was going to vote NDP, but she wasn't a partisan. And she walked in and said, you know, I'm never going to vote for you. And Clark said, good for you. We live in a democracy. And Linda said, I hope you don't get in. And it seemed to end there. Clark
yeah.
has interactions like that, hundreds of them every single day, positive and negative. So Clark walks away. And then suddenly this story started to build around who was Linda? Did the NDP send her there to derail the event? Which wasn't true. And I interviewed Linda that evening or the next evening, and she told me, you know, she was on the phone with her brother, and there was all sorts of conspiracy theories the Liberals were pushing about who this Linda Higgins was.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the Liberals ended up looking pretty silly by saying that she was a plant hired by the NDP to go there. And over time, the story could have disappeared, but reporters every day were asking Clark about it, and Clark said she was a plant, and Clark wouldn't apologize, and then eventually, by the end of the week, she realized that, you know, it was a losing battle,
yeah.
and still to this day, we write in the book that Clark still believes that Linda was sent there by the NDP.
I think in the election campaign, the Liberals were hobbled by the fact they ran a provincial campaign, and this was an election in which the NDP did not. They ran a Lower Mainland campaign and ignored the interior entirely, and it was a weird election because there was two different campaigns going on. You know, there was the Lower Mainland fight for transit, housing affordability, and then there was the interior fight for jobs and the natural resource, economy. And, you know, the NDP did not win the election. The Liberals came very, very close, just a handful of votes in Courtney Comox, mm-hmm. and they could have had another majority. We wouldn't even be talking mm-hmm. at that point. And so it's a warning for the NDP. As much as they're in power right now, they need to do a much better job running a provincial election campaign. And the Liberals were hobbled by the fact that their cabinet and caucus was full of rural MLAs, MLAs from the interior who looked at Metro Vancouver and said, why are we giving them such a break on transit?
Yeah.
And they had this internal tension that the NDP didn't have because they don't have any rural interior MLAs. And that's an issue for Horgan going forward, is that don't get too comfortable in the Premier's office. You don't represent the whole province. In fact, you represent a very narrow slice of the coast.
And what many people forget is with all the gains the NDP made, they lost two significant seats outside of Metro Vancouver. They lost Skeena,
up north,
which is Kitimat, mm-hmm. and they lost Columbia Revelstoke, which is Revelstoke is the biggest community there. And so those would have been significant rural voices. Norm MacDonald and Robin Austin filled those seats before for the NDP. They both retired. The NDP lost those in part because of this crazy policy equity mandate that they have, and in both cases ran candidates that had very questionable credentials in terms of the equity mandate, and they lost those seats. They didn't go to those ridings during the election. They didn't focus on winning those types of seats, and so, you know, Horgan is spending time during constituency week, which is right now going to those communities. He's in the interior this week. Last week he was up north, and those are the places he needs to go. And I'll be curious to see over the next few weeks if we start seeing announcements in Victoria that are reflective of what he learned on that trip.
And NDP leaders usually get done in by their own caucus or infighting within their own party.
That's what's fun about BC politics.
Yeah, and so do you think then that this equity thing, I mean, this is something that this party has been...
2013 it came in.
Yeah, and it's something that they've been really, it's been tearing them apart.
Well, you know, the NDP are different from the Liberals. Their party is a actual functioning democratic party, and the members and the council that they have, they want to influence the policies and they want to be involved in the ridings. And so they set things like gender equity and equity mandates, and they would rather lose than adjust their mandates, and they did lose ridings because of that. The Liberals are just this, you know, they're a free enterprise coalition, but the party never gets in the way of winning, mm-hmm. you know, and so the NDP are different that way. They just have a different makeup, and that's why the party has no problem taking out its own leader, even when they're premier, if the party members decide that they want to go in a different direction. And John Horgan's aware of that. I mean, he served several premiers, watched them come and go mm-hmm. in the 90s, and he's certainly aware that... they could, you know, the party could come for him one day, and that could just be the end of his premiership.
Yeah. You know, the so many great things that we learn in this book. One of them is that, well, I guess people know that he's a big sci-fi fan, Horgan is. And what I can't reconcile in my head as I'm thinking of the book is, despite that, he's very superstitious.
I thought you were going to say you couldn't reconcile that he likes Voyager over Next Generation, which makes no sense to me.
Well, I don't watch Star Trek. Okay. But I mean,
Rob can debate that for a while.
I'll debate it amongst myself in the next 20 minutes. Yeah.
Is Star Wars different than Star Trek?
No, okay. Turn off his mic.
he is a hugely superstitious person.
Getting off the bus and he has to touch the guy on the shoulder?
And he lost the feather.
There was a special feather.
And found it in the bus depot garbage bin. And Horgan is an interesting character like that, you know. And I think that one of the things that appeals to people about John Horgan is he's authentic. You meet John Horgan, and he is who he is. And people often wondered about Christy Clark. Who is the real Christy Clark? You know, and you didn't see her when you met her. She was very charming. She's a fantastic retail politician, but mm-hmm. that was not Christy Clark. And you meet John Horgan, and that's just who he is. We've talked to him quite a bit. He doesn't put on the same layers as Christy Clark did. And he connects with the public to his credit, because I know Adrian Dix in 2013, people felt like him running a positive campaign, that wasn't Adrian Dix. Like, who is this guy pretending to be someone he's not? And authenticity is important in politics, and Horgan is displaying it.
Horgan also has this deep connection to human beings that live in our communities, right? Two of them come to mind. Roderick MacIsaac is one. He committed suicide after he was fired as one of the health researchers. And that health firings issue has been a massive one, and Rob has spent a lot of time covering it. And Adrian Dix, the health minister now, and John Horgan worked on those issues and felt this incredible injustice of what happened, that these eight workers were fired that shouldn't have been, and the government, the previous government, the Liberal government, trumped up this, you know, said there was an RCMP investigation, which wasn't the case. And the reason I bring it up is because the night of the election, Horgan and Weaver spoke, and Horgan said to Weaver, remember Roderick MacIsaac. Mm. And I think he has this deep emotional tie to injustice, Horgan does. And the other one is Max Saney, who is the toddler in East Vancouver who died in childcare. And Horgan has a picture of him in his office and feels like he owes the Saney family a fix to the problem. And that's part of the childcare investment we're seeing, is it's so personally attached to this young child that Horgan feels this deep attachment to and sorrow for the family. And, you know, in politics, there are politicians who sometimes use others to their advantage, stooges or whatever you may describe them. I believe in both those cases is truly authentic, that Horgan feels deep remorse and sadness about the death of those two people and has used those stories to try to make better public policy.
Is the temper thing, is that overblown?
No, I mean, I covered Horgan for 10 years, and he has a temper. There's no getting around that. And I think the issue is not that he has one or try to change him, is that there was an image reshuffling there that he's a passionate fighter for the underdog. Mm. He gets angry at injustice, and they managed to successfully change his image there. But he had a long journey, we chronicle in the book, to understand how to better portray himself. And he used to bristle at questions he didn't like. And he'd attack, you know, if you had him on the air and you started asking him something he didn't like, it, he'd start coming at you a little bit. You know, like, what are you doing?
Star Trek was stupid.
Yeah, starting that one too. And he had to learn, it sounds obvious, but he had to learn that even if you don't like the question, it's still an opportunity for you to talk about something you do want to talk about. And it took him a while because he doesn't take advice from a lot of people, and he doesn't trust a lot of people. And it took a while for him to get to that point where he understood what he needed to do. And give him full credit, because during the election, this incredibly, probably the most stressful period of his life, he metamorphosized into a different politician. And the John Horgan we see now is the one that everyone who tried to convince him to run for leader, they thought he could be this premier. They're like, oh, I think you could be this John Horgan. And no one was sure if he could get there. And he's gone on this journey, and it looks like he's there.
That goes to Christy Clark now, because a lot of people didn't like her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading the book, and I'm thinking, the Christy Clark that you guys talked to, if you didn't like her, you probably would like her after sort of the interactions you've had with her. Is that a fair assessment?
We tried really hard to be fair and humanize Christy Clark, because I think, you know, in politics, people like to make a very superficial judgment of you. And she had a tremendous number of people who disliked her, especially female voters. And we tried to show a little bit of the other side of her. She is a polarizing figure, and there's many layers to Christy Clark, and I don't know if we've seen all of them. And I don't know if this is the last we've seen of her in public life either. But
you think it's a little too late, though, don't you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's more of a matter of, I think we just felt like, one of the chapters I like most in the book is one where we talk about that she broke so many glass ceilings as a female leader, and she didn't get a lot of credit for it because so many people hated her.
Yeah.
And people didn't give her the benefit of the doubt. When she brought her son out on the campaign trail, people were like, well, you must be using him as a political tool.
Yeah.
And she, when you ask her, says, well, I wanted to teach him about public service, because in church, that's what we talk about. Some people didn't believe that. They didn't believe anything she said. And so I think history over time may look back at Christy Clark and give her more credit for the strong female leadership she provided, the ceilings that she broke. But now she just remains intensely disliked by a lot of people.
She also helped recruit strong women candidates, and part of the book details how hard it is for women to get into politics, family reasons, but also the intense public scrutiny that women seem to get more of than men do that enter politics. But the two best examples are Michelle Stilwell, recruited for 2013, Paralympic gold medalist, was a minister in Clark's cabinet, and then Tracy Reddies was recruited in 2017, who's now in opposition but one of the two finance critics. And I think Clark, by bringing in strong women, helps create a more balanced caucus and previously cabinet, And helps add to the political dialogue in this province. Having those voices is important as our elected representatives.
There's a chapter in the book, and it's worth reading because it talks about the sexism that remains in politics. Yeah. and how even though we've had a female leader elected twice, nothing's really changed in that regard. I mean, this casual sexism is still there, right?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately, and you know, Carol James dealt with it too as leader of the NDP. The obsession on the female politicians' clothes and their appearance and
hairstyle, whether you dye your hair or not.
Yeah, and Christy Clark said, you know, in meetings she would go into meetings where you know, especially investors from other countries would come in and start talking to her male staff before her, and you know, she's the boss. She actually reconfigured the seating in her office so that they would have to look at her, and you know, you couldn't avoid her. And I mean, that's a kind of a sad commentary on where we are and at you know, in the 2017, and we have two male you know, three male party leaders now, and you know, they're not going to have to deal with that. But it's worth going back and looking, I think, you know, as more time passes, on what Christy Clark went through and what it means to our society, because it was extremely disappointing to watch some people start talking about her dresses and cleavage in the middle of a legislature debate on you know, developmentally disabled children in care, and no one talks about that. They start talking about her dress, and I think we were all surprised by how that happened.
She said something during the Me Too stuff, or just before that. Well, she said years ago that it was an old boys' network in Victoria.
Yeah.
And then during the Me Too stuff, I remember her saying that there was this frat boy culture
right.
at the legislature. Is that something that you've seen, you guys?
Yeah, so we don't run often in the same circles that they do. But you feel that wherever you go in politics. And I think things are changing in the gallery. You know, we have added over the last few years, I think there are four new members and three of them are women, and I'm the fourth. And I think that helps with the renewal too, is more representation in the press gallery, I think in politics as well. And, you know, many of the staffers previously in and around the Liberals were men. I think we're seeing that gender change too. When you just look down the hallways and look at the staffers for both the Liberals and the NDP government, more women are in the hallways. I think that helps change the frat boy culture. There was a long time a culture of drinking in and around the building. You know, early in the day, 3, 4, or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, people would start drinking. You don't see that anymore. You know, it's a different culture around the way that politics is done and reporting is done around politics, which I think is good. But I think Clark is right that there has been this frat boy culture that has developed not just in British Columbia. It's in politics everywhere you look. And that's slowly changing for various different reasons, and I think for the better.
There's a moment in the book where you talk about a meeting that Clark had with Catherine McKenna, the federal environment minister. And I thought that was fascinating because I guess that shows just how skilled she was at reading a room and, I guess, negotiating with someone that you have to deal with.
And I also – so the story in the book is that the last minute, they had this meeting where Catherine McKenna tried to jam Christy Clark with some last minute concessions on the national carbon plan, a national environmental plan, in exchange for approving the LNG project federally that Christy Clark wanted. And Clark went into this meeting and took one look at McKenna and sized her up and realized she could just steamroll her.
Mm-hmm.
And just basically laughs in the federal minister's face at this meeting and says, forget it. Like, let's go out and do this thing. And, you know, it was extremely skilled at reading people. That's why in one of the chapters we mentioned she went in to meet the lieutenant governor on Government House night and took one look at her, sized her up, and realized that she wasn't going to get her election call. And then that's part of what made her such an incredible politician. And it's one of the reasons Richard talked about I Am Linda. It's one of the, the perplexities, I guess, of the election campaign is that she could have handled those things so easily, and she misstepped, she stumbled, and it was just enough that she looked like she lost her edge.
She was also sick during the campaign, which I think you know, Clark has worked through a lot of adversity, but I remember both Rob and I did our profile stories with her right around the same time, and I think she moved Rob's by one day because she had a bad flu. And then when I interviewed her, she was still struggling with it, and she got sick again in the campaign. And I think that plays a role too, right? It's so physically draining doing this, meeting hundreds of people, doing big speeches, interacting. You're not eating well. You're not getting enough water. You're not taking care of yourself as you should. Clark was an excessive exerciser, and she spent time focusing on doing that every day. But during the campaign, you lose some of that. And when you get sick, it's, you know, for anyone, it's harder to do your job. It's harder to stay focused. And I think that contributed a little bit to some of the lack of energy maybe, or some of the mistakes that she made in the campaign.
Have you got any insight, because you talk in the book about how Campbell handled his cabinet and how Clark handled his cabinet. Have you got any sense of how Horgan is doing?
I mean, he had a really tough decision on Site C, and he took a much more conciliatory approach to bringing in outside experts, which I don't think Clark did very often, and coming to a consensus on an issue, which is more Christy Clark style. He's not ruling like Gordon Campbell did. And, I, you know, one of the things that I find interesting about putting those three premiers in the book is this question of how do we want our province to be run, and how do we look back on the accomplishments of government? Gordon Campbell did all of these things, but he also did them pretty much by himself. He ruled through fear. He did his minister's jobs for him. He pivoted government on his own whim every year, depending on the books he was reading.
Yeah.
Christy Clark didn't do that, and... But people look back on Gordon Campbell as this decisive leader, this visionary. And Clark, by giving more leeway to her own cabinet and making more consensus decisions, doesn't get that same description. And I kind of wonder about how history will reconcile those two things. You don't really want a government run by one person, like some sort of dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But we tend to reward that when we describe it as leadership. And I don't know, Clark, you know, maybe she doesn't get that credit because she and Horgan certainly don't run things the way that Campbell did.
I guess if PR comes in, do you think that that'll change the way we govern ourselves?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we have coalitions all the time, I mean, I think the first thing that'll happen is, and we've seen this in the Green NDP, you know, power sharing deals, their election platforms, what we voted for, almost become irrelevant because the parties then go behind closed doors and develop a power sharing agreement that they do that you didn't vote on. No one voted on the confidence supply agreement that the NDP and Greens govern on now.
Right.
And when we bring up their platforms to them and say, didn't you run on this issue? They say, well, yeah, but that's not part of the CASA agreement. That'll be the biggest issue, I think, if you have PR and coalition governments, is you vote for one thing, you get another based on how the parties get together.
A couple of things before we wrap up. Has anyone that you talked to in the book, have you heard from them since the book's come out, and have they walked anything back, to use a silly phrase?
No, it's, you know, we're hearing from lots of people now, and everybody is concerned about how they look. And, you know, one of the interesting things to me was about, we haven't gotten much into it, so I don't want to open up another box here, but the clone speech, as it's been known, this throne speech that was done, and I laughed when one liberal said to me, a lot of people are distancing themselves pretty quickly from that speech, and they were a little bit more involved than maybe you mentioned in the book, but, you know, that's part of that, how divisive that speech was. But I think I think people are, I've been amazed with how supportive people have been that we interviewed and have detailed in the book, and I think people are also really concerned about how they look. I think, as Rob says this often, as journalists, we're only doing our job if, you know, people like part of it but don't like other parts of it. You know, we don't want everybody to like everything that we do because we're trying to be as fair and honest and sometimes as critical as possible around things that we're done.
And as our name's in the book, I mean, we wrote it in a specific style that we take ownership for what it is. And, you know, if the leaders don't like it...
They know where to find us.
We're fine with that. You know, that's just the way we do our journalism. Not everyone likes everything we do.
It's one of those books that I guess people in Victoria went to the back first to see if they were mentioned in the index,
so
right?
So people in Monroe's, the great bookstore in Victoria, the staffers there told us that there was a steady stream of government staffers and opposition staffers. It all came in the first thing they all did. And they said, oh, thankfully I got more mentions than this guy. Or, oh, no, he had more mentions than me. Or I wasn't in the book at all. And so it is funny to hear from people that way.
The constitutional aspect of this and the role of the lieutenant governor is something we haven't touched, but I just want to ask you one thing about that. Say the NDP government falls and the Greens decide to coalesce with the Liberals. Would we have another government without an election?
I don't think so. I talked to a lot of constitutional experts around this time, and they said there's kind of usually this six-month window after an election where if a government falls, it's incumbent upon the LG to try to find another party that can govern before you, because it's voter fatigue to continually plunge the electorate into another election. Mm-hmm. We already have such low voter turnout. Having to do another election 4 weeks after one we just did, you get even worse turnout. So I think if the NDP loses confidence of the Greens and they lose confidence of the House, we're definitely going to do another election.
Right. New lieutenant governor, new Liberal leader. There's just too many new factors here that would make it almost impossible for a new lieutenant governor to say, okay, try it out with the Liberals with their new leader. At this point, I think enough time has passed that it could be, there could be a potential new election.
If we get PR and we get coalition governments after every election, what happened in 2017 is going to be a precedent-setting example of how an LG handles, whichever party gets the most seats will try and come into the legislature and govern, get defeated, and then it will be a matter of the LG having to decide what to do. And so there's a precedent set here to give parties another chance in those first few months, a different party, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen every time. It'll depend on the LG and the circumstances.
The other thing, because you guys cover Victoria, when you look at your reporter colleagues who cover Trump and Washington, that capital, do you envy them?
18-hour days, things changing hour to hour. You can't even believe what's coming out of his mouth because sometimes it's not even true. I don't know. We had a pretty good run. We wrote a book about it.
There were some long days here, long nights too.
Yeah, that was incredible. I think I would lose my mind if we had to cover that on a daily basis.
You cover Trump and then they deny, what he said.
Yeah,
and
they
try to turn it on you. There's a war against the media in the U.S. that we have yet to really experience in Canada, and it would be very frustrating to be part of that, I think.
Has this encouraged you to write other books?
Maybe about boy wizards. I think I might be there in the future. But I don't know. I mean, it has been surprising. Maybe there are other political books out there. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
Did you enjoy working together?
Yes,
it was awesome.
I've talked to people who've written books together, and it's funny how when it's time to promote the book, the publicist says, "Well, they'll talk separately."
I think our friendship is better now, and I went through a lot of personal adversity through this book, and Rob was there with me every step of the way, and our friendship is, better, and we're going on a tour now to Kamloops and Kelowna together. It's just, it's been really nice, and it's been special that we get to enjoy this together, and we get to follow along with people tweeting about it and buying the book, and we get to celebrate that together, and it's been really, really amazing. And
you guys have done a service, because, you can see just through sales alone how much people are interested in politics,
which is
history.
It's refreshing. We weren't sure that they would be, and maybe that's because it was so interesting the last few years. But for whatever reason, people want to read it, so we're happy about that.
It's a pleasure to meet you both. I've admired your work for years, congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Thank you for having us on.
The book is called The Matter of Confidence, The Inside Story of the Political Battle for BC. It's published by Heritage House. Rob Shaw and Richard Zussman join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.